Chapter 17, A Closer Look at the Judeo-Christian Hoax. We have reviewed the Old Testament and found it to be basically a collection of dirty stories about dirty, whoremongering Jews, such as Abraham, Judah, David, Solomon, and many others. We have taken a closer look at the New Testament and found that it, too, was written by a parcel of Jews. Whereas the Old Testament served as a rallying creed for the unification of the Jewish race, we find that the New Testament doing just the opposite for the white race. Namely, it was designed to confuse, confound, divide, and disintegrate the white race by overwhelming it with so much drivel and with such a multitude of bad advice as to leave the white race naked and defenseless before the rapacious Jew. In this chapter, I want to examine further the old Judeo-Christian hoax as set forth in both the Old and the New Testament, since combined they constitute the white man's Bible. The Bible, in turn, is the foundation of his religion, called Christianity, which has been such an unfortunate catastrophe for the white man during the last 2,000 years of his history. The last thing the white race needs for its survival is a collection of bad advice. This, however, is exactly what the Christian religion does give the white man: a multitude of just outright bad and suicidal advice that, if followed, will most surely destroy those that embrace it. Christianity despises facts. It despises evidence and reasoning. It despises thinking men. It wants believing sheep. It loves gullible fools. Christ is quoted as saying, "Unless ye become like little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." It wants to reduce everyone to a simple, childlike condition, where they are easily duped and misled to believe just about anything. It wants to reduce the creative, productive, heroic, and energetic white race down to where they are meek and submissive fools, easily managed, easily controlled, and easily enslaved. Christianity is a treacherous mental snare. It rapes the minds of otherwise intelligent men. Once it has the majority under its control, it then resorts to force, if necessary, to break and destroy those who will still insist upon thinking for themselves. When that great early scientist, Galileo, in 1632, brought logical evidence to show that the earth revolved around the sun and that the sun itself was part of a vast interstellar system, it was the Christian Church which immediately was aroused to stop this advance in scientific thinking. In the following year, Galileo was summoned to Rome, where he was examined by the Inquisition, humiliated and forced to kneel before a vast assembly and renounce his findings. This is only one of the thousands of cases where the Christian religion used force and terror to stifle and paralyze the minds of thinking men. Christianity thrives on lies. It has built a whole network of lies, one layer parlayed upon another. One lie designed to seemingly substantiate another in an endless chain until the average person is confused and so overwhelmed by the massiveness of it all that he is psychologically browbeaten into accepting the whole carload of lies as being God's unalterable truth. Here is one of the first and most obvious lies, one that even a child can see through, namely that every word in the Bible was God's unalterable word, being exactly as he has set it down, and not a letter having been changed. It is obvious to even the most simple-minded person that the Bible has been changed continuously and repeatedly. For instance, we have the Vulgate edition of the Bible for the Catholics. We have the King James Version for the fundamentalist Christians. We have the Revised Standard Version for the more modern Christians. And just the other day, I went to the bookstore and bought the New English Bible, which throws all the others overboard and puts it into a more readable prose. In going back to the encyclopedia, I find that the Bible has been translated from the Greek into the Latin, from the Latin into English, German, and a multitude of other languages. Whatever version these translations came out as was completely dependent upon the whim and interpretation of the translator. In fact, the encyclopedia says further that the Bible has, over the last 1,000 and some years of its existence, had more than 100,000 changes made in it, but then adds quickly and apologetically that only 5% of these were significant. It would seem to me that any changes in the unalterable Word of God would be significant, and 100,000 changes would render it a completely different animal, to say the least. But even taking the 5% figure as such, that would still make 5,000 significant changes spread over approximately 1,000 pages of the Bible. That would leave 95 so-called insignificant changes and 5 significant changes per page. It doesn't take a great deal of brains to conclude that the Bible has certainly been changed continuously and significantly, and to claim that it has been unaltered from the very beginning is only one major lie in the whole chain to follow. The whole network of the Bible itself is shot through with contradictions and inconsistencies of what it says in itself, one part with another. In other words, the Bible is continually contradicting itself and making a liar out of itself. Not only that, but the whole story is so illogical and ludicrous that even as a teenager a number of perplexing questions arose in my mind. One of the first of these was that why, if God was such a kind and loving God, were most of the people that he had made with such tender, loving care, were these people, by and large, all going to hell? It is still a good question, basic and fundamental, and it is one that no preacher, no matter how much double talk he has given me, has ever successfully answered. When we examine the whole story structure as set forth in the Old Testament, we find something like the following, if we were gullible enough to believe the Jewish scriptwriters who wrote it. In the beginning, everything was void, and God was evidently just floating around in this void with nothing to do, nothing to think about, nothing to see. There was no light. After being in suspended animation for billions and billions and billions of years, like that, Suddenly, only about 6,000 years ago, he got the idea of creating heaven and earth. It didn't say that he created hell, but evidently he must have created it at the same time, with the idea of putting somebody in it in the future. Since that is where most people were destined to go, he must have created an extra-large hell comparatively. In any case, on the sixth day he created man in his own image, blessed him, and put him in the Garden of Eden. We get the impression that it was God's original intention to have man live in the Garden of Eden forever. However, then a curious thing happened. Adam and Eve hadn't been in this garden for more than a day when they were booby-trapped into eating some forbidden fruit. Why the tree was there in the first place, why it was such a crime to eat its fruit, why the Lord put the serpent there to encourage and persuade them into eating the fruit, why the good Lord didn't give Adam and Eve more sense to be taken in by the serpent, no one has ever explained to me. In any case, for this horrible crime of eating the fruit from this particular tree, evidently the Lord's whole place for the human race changed instantly. We are being led to believe by the Jewish scriptwriters. He was angry with Adam and Eve for this little blunder, and no longer was he a forgiving and loving God. But instead, in anger, he drove them out of the Garden of Eden and cursed them to earn their bread by the sweat of their brow. From this little insignificant incident, we are told the whole human race is now cursed with the original sin of Adam and Eve. As ludicrous as this story is, a multitude of logical questions arise. Since we are told the Lord knows all, sees all, knows the future as well as the past, and not a hair falls from our head, nor a sparrow from the roof, without him knowing it, how does it happen that he didn't know long in advance that Adam and Eve were going to do just what they did do, and that he was going to drive them out of the Garden of Eden? He must have known this and planned it in that way before he even created them or anything else. If he did know all this in advance, and in fact, he constructed the whole universe, including the creatures of mankind, God cannot very well escape the responsibility of having planned it that way. After all, mankind was a creation of God himself, who knows all, sees all, knows everything in the future, forward and backward. If man turned out to be such a dastardly sinner, then we must also assume that God designed him that way and intended him to be that way. As mankind multiplied, so the story continues, he became exceedingly sinful, and God decided that he would drown them all except for one family, namely that of Noah. The kind and loving God, the one we are told loves us all, then set about to drown all these people like a miserable bunch of rats. This, according to one version of the Bible that I have, that places dates on everything, occurred in the year 2348 BC, in a deluge that lasted 40 days and 40 nights. According to the Jewish scriptwriters that wrote this ridiculous story, Noah, being forewarned by the Lord, built an ark and took into it every living thing of all flesh, both of fowl and of cattle, and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. When we consider that there are 10 million species of insects alone, not to mention the number of reptiles, birds, animals, and what have you. This story certainly becomes more implausible than the story of Alice in Wonderland. Nor does the fact that there is absolutely no evidence that the whole earth was covered with water in the year 2348 BC, or thereabouts, particularly bother these Jewish script writers, nor all these preachers that go about spouting these claims. Contemporary Egyptian historians mentioned no such floods. How contradictory all this is, when the evidence of nature before us. When we look at the Grand Canyon, for instance, that has been eroding in its channels for many millions of years. When we look at the glaciers that have been around for hundreds of thousands of years. When we look at the evolvement of the different species such as horses, mastodons, or the saber-toothed tiger, or the more recent historical development of man himself that goes back far beyond the 2348 BC, a person just has to simply take leave of his senses, become gullible like a child, in order to believe this nonsense. The story then goes on, and soon Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs of the Jewish race, appear upon the scene. According to their own stories, these people were all a bunch of moral profligates, as we have read about in the chapters previously. But according to the Jewish script writers, God took a special fancy to this group and made all kinds of lavish, far-reaching, and overly generous promises to them and to their seed. He made a special sweetheart arrangement with them. The Jews therewith claim that they have a special covenant with God, that they are the chosen people, and that they have the inside track with the Lord himself. One of their major organizations, the B'nai B'rith, means Sons of the Covenant. Again the question arises, why would the Lord, who is supposed to be so righteous, so just, and so wise, make a special sweetheart arrangement with such a group of perfidious cutthroats, scoundrels, whoremongers, pimps, and prostitutes, such as, e.g., Abraham and Sarah? It's a great story for the Jews, but a pretty stupid story for us Gentiles to incorporate into our religion. So far, we find that God has made a bad mistake with Adam and Eve, and has driven them out of the Garden of Eden. Their seed evidently turned out badly. He tried to correct this second mistake by drowning all except for one family. Evidently, that was a bad choice also, because Noah's progeny turned out so badly that the Lord decided something drastic had to be done again, short of drowning them all the second time. Since mankind was so bad, so wicked, and so sinful, he decided to do something really meaningful. In the second part of the Bible, which is the New Testament, it says that the Holy Ghost descended upon the Virgin Mary, and she became pregnant. She conceived God's only begotten Son, who was to save mankind from this horrible fate, evidently going to hell. This is indeed a droll and fantastic story. To think that this all-powerful Creator, who could create the earth, and the sun, and the Milky Way, and the galaxies billions of light-years away, a universe so vast in which the earth is only a mere speck, and man upon it is more like an atom, that such a supernatural being would have to stoop to the idea of having intercourse with an earthly creature, and a married Jewish woman at that. all this so that she could raise up his son, only to have him nailed to the cross, seems so fantastically far-fetched and idiotic that you sometimes wonder about the sanity of the human race as a whole. In any case, that is the story, as set forth by the Jewish script writers, of unknown origin, and hundreds of millions of people have been gullible enough to swallow it. The whole idea of "he died for our sins" in itself is not a very reasonable one. It is something as if, for an instance, a bunch of niggers commit a number of murders, thefts and crimes, and burned down the city of Detroit, and then you took a good, upstanding white citizen, humiliated him, spat upon him, nailed him to the cross, and then drove a spear into his side to make his blood run, and this was to atone those niggers having committed all those crimes? What kind of justice is that? How would this atone for their crimes? How would that teach those niggers a lesson in any way, shape, or form? This whole story about "he died for our sins" is about as ridiculous and as idiotic as the example I just quoted. In any case, evidently 2,000 years later, looking back on it now, we certainly can't say that this strange, humiliating act that the Lord condescended to in order to save mankind has worked. And evidently, we can chalk up another blooper and failure against the workings of God. It seems as though, throughout the thread and story of the Bible, our Creator is just blundering from one bad mistake to another, and none of the programs seem to work out the way they should. When we contrast this with the real world and the laws of nature, how completely in conflict this is with what our common sense, our eyes and our ears tell us. It is completely unthinkable that any of the laws of nature have ever broken down, or have ever failed, or have ever been in conflict with each other. We know of no case where the law of gravity was suspended, not the laws of light, nor the laws of electricity, or the laws of magnetism, nor were any other laws of nature ever in conflict with each other, nor did they fail to work. In fact, nature's laws have been performing flawlessly, immutably, and inexorably from time immemorial, and will undoubtedly continue to do so in all eternity. In any case, if we just use an ounce of common sense and use the intelligence with which nature has so gratuitously endowed us, we can't help but come to the conclusion that Christ's appearance on earth and being nailed to the cross did not do any great wonders for mankind. An overwhelming contradiction that manifests itself here is that the Jews, who wrote the New Testament, sold this story to the white people only, and the Jewish race, who are supposedly God's chosen and God's favored, never did believe in Christ. Ask some preacher to explain this idiotic contradiction to you, and he'll give you an hour's worth of double talk. Therefore, another obvious contradiction looms before our eyes, and that is, why would the Jews be God's chosen people? Why would Christ, who is God's Son, be made to die on the cross in order to save mankind, and yet at the same time fail to convince the Jews God's chosen people? The whole thing doesn't make sense. Furthermore, in the first chapter of Matthew, it makes it abundantly clear that Christ was a direct descendant from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, through those whoremongering kings of David and Solomon, and right on through to Joseph, Christ's father. Furthermore, it makes it quite clear that Christ was a circumcised Jew. In Luke 2:21, it says, "When 8 days were accomplished for circumcising the child, his name was called Jesus." We therefore have the New Testament saying that Christ was a Jew, descendant in the long lineage from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At the same time, we are told, however, that he was called the Son of God. At the same time, God's chosen didn't believe it. A rather contradictory and a most ridiculous story, to say the least. So here is the white man, saddled with a religion that is in the first part overwhelming about Jews and God's infatuation with that perfidious parasitic race, and in the second part of God's impregnating and fertilizing a Jewish married woman who has a son, supposedly the Son of God, but at the same time he is the son of Joseph, and proudly having his male lineage listed all the way back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then we have the situation where the Jews themselves don't believe the second part of the story, namely the New Testament, but by a huge concerted effort that lasted approximately 300 years, they finally convinced the white Roman civilization that this was to be their new religion. And the white man bought it. How silly can you get? Preachers and missionaries will make a big to-do about how Christ gave us everlasting life. We are supposed to be so eternally and forever grateful for this magnanimous gift. This, again, is completely contrary to what we see in nature. We know of no species, of no individual that nature has ever given everlasting life, anywhere, at any time. There just isn't a single shred of evidence to back up any of this nonsense. Most plants live only one season, produce their seed and die, only to have a new generation come up in the following spring. Most mammals, like deer, rabbits, coyotes, etc., live only a matter of 1 or 2 to perhaps 6 years on average and die. During their life period, they have produced enough offspring to carry on the species. There is not a shred of evidence that man fares differently. In any case, who said that we would want everlasting life, even if we could have the choice, especially if there might be a dismal and torturous hell waiting for us and we can't terminate the period of our torture? Or even if there was such a place as heaven to go to, who says that we are especially fond of playing the harp forever and praising the Lord? It would seem to me that such indulgence could get awfully boring after a relatively short time. Furthermore, the Bible telling us most of us are going to go to hell anyway, probably about 99%, what is so great about everlasting life? The answer is nothing, of course, and it is a great big Jewish hoax. There just isn't a single shred of evidence to back it up. It is contrary to all observations that we have witnessed in nature, and we can chalk this down too as another one of the Jewish network of lies. When it comes to frightening and terrorizing the minds of his victims with the fiendish and hideous characteristics of hell, the details are brutal and vivid. The great loving God who created us all had evidently planned from the beginning to send 99% of us to a confined torture chamber where we could be forever tortured in a blazing fire, from which there is no escape. When it comes to heaven however, the details are completely missing. In fact, the description, except for how it's lined with gold and precious stones and all that, are pretty nebulous. Evidently, our main preoccupation will be praising the Lord. I can't think of anything more boring and more ungodlike than to have a huge herd of captive subjects rendering praise day and night to their master. How tyrannical! We are continually told in the Bible that we should be meek and not vain, and that any pride that we might have is sinful. Yet how vainglorious is our supposed Creator! Here he is, creating a huge herd, a captive audience, that will spend the next millions of years doing practically nothing but mouthing praise. If this is a godlike attribute, then it contradicts all other values that are prescribed in the Bible. On the other hand, it then pictures us as angels playing a harp, perhaps. Frankly, I have never looked forward with any great anticipation towards playing a harp. If that was such a wonderful and joyous pastime, I would have purchased one a long time ago. But I don't see very many other people particularly enraptured about playing a harp. So what else is there to do in heaven? Do we eat? Do we wear clothes? Do we sleep? Are we solid? Are we a bunch of spirits flitting through the ether? Do we have wings? The only answer is we don't know any of these things. It is all very vague, very hazy, very nebulous. And as to the location of this wonderful heaven that we are supposed to be knocking ourselves out for, just where is it located? Is it 1,000 miles above the earth? 1,000,000 miles below the earth? 100,000,000 miles away? Is it near the sun? Is it in this galaxy? Is it really anywhere? And again, the answer is vague and nebulous. Jesus is quoted as saying, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall never pass away." Are we then to understand that heaven is only temporary? Well, some say there is a second heaven. So, is it also temporary or what? It is all very sketchy, very mysterious, very muddy, and very dubious. It has all come down to us from 100 hand-downs of second-hand hearsay that has been revised and rewritten and repatched 100,000 times. And we are supposed to take it all as the gospel truth. It would seem to me that if the difference between doing the right thing and the wrong thing would mean between going to heaven and eternal hellfire, that God would have made it abundantly clear what it is that he wants us to do. If I had a hired man and gave him the alternatives, that by doing the right thing, he would be rewarded with $1,000,000. But if he did the wrong thing, I would shoot him. Then the least thing I could do would be to make it crystal clear what it is he must do and what he must not do. Similarly, if what the Bible says has any validity at all, and it does not, then God would certainly not have confused us with 1,000 differing religions, Mohammedanism, Judaism, Mormonism, Confucianism, Christianity, and a host of lesser creeds. He most certainly would not have splintered the Christian religion into 1,000 different branches, such as Catholics, Unitarians, Methodists, Holy Rollers and what have you, all of which denounce and discredit each other. Even if you wanted to do the right thing, who is on the right track? The Mohammedans, the Jews who don't believe in Christianity. From such a mass of confusion, How could you possibly ever tell? The whole mess of garbage, of course, breaks down miserably. We return to our senses, take a breath of cool, clean air, and go back to the laws of nature, which are real, which are in harmony, which are eternal. All truth and all knowledge originates from our observations of the laws of nature. What these born-again Christians will try to trap you with is, how do you explain all the universe around you? Somebody had to make all this. If they are a more sophisticated philosopher, they will phrase it this way. There has to be a first cause, and this first cause is God. This is a lame assumption and a most unwarranted presumption. We have no evidence whatsoever that this presumption has any basis in fact. We don't know but that the universe has not been here forever and will be here forever in the future. Whereas the scenes of nature are eternally changing, it is nevertheless always the same, and the laws of nature itself have never changed. They are eternal. In fact, as far as time is concerned, we don't even know what the term itself means, except as it is related to the movements of the planets or some other moving object. It can be argued just as effectively that the universe has always been here, as to say that God has always been here. In answer to the argument that somebody had to create all this, it can just as validly be argued that, well, then somebody else had to create God in the first place. It is just as reasonable to assume that the universe, constantly changing as it is, could not suddenly spring into existence out of nothing as that the Creator sprang out of nothing. It makes just as much sense to argue that somebody first had to create God as it does to argue that somebody first had to create the universe. So we are left with the obvious. The answer is simply we don't know how it all started, if there ever was a beginning. The universe, as far as we know, has always been here. About the mystery of a god or gods, we have no evidence. We know nothing. And as far as anyone can tell, there are thousands of myths and stories and fairy tales about gods and goddesses, spirits and angels, and devils and fairies, and gods and gremlins. But as far as any evidence is concerned, all we know is that they are only a product of a man's fertile imagination. To succumb to the Christian philosophy is to indulge in a cowardly fright from reality, to escape to an Alice in Wonderland fantasy world, and to destroy reason and common sense. We repeat, Christianity despises facts, evidence, and reasoning. Christianity despises logic. To become a Christian is to succumb to the perversion of one's mind by Jewish mind manipulation. A born-again Christian is a pervert. He has had his instincts warped, his mind unhinged, and his total outlook on life, outlook on sex, and on the survival of his kind, completely perverted from that which as a natural human being he was originally created by nature. He becomes a destroyer of his own race. Although the matter of becoming a Christian is a matter of degree, and very few people of the white race actually take it seriously, nevertheless, everybody pretty well passively consents to its domination of our outlook and our society. This in itself is a very significant concession, and one that has had catastrophic effects on the culture, government, and outlook of the white race over the last 2,000 years. And herein lies the white man's dilemma in politics, in business, in warfare, and in all his other actions. He uses the instincts and common sense with which nature endowed him so richly. He invokes the law of survival, the law of nature, and those of his own experience. Then he goes to church on Sunday and has his brains remanipulated to repudiate all his common sense. He goes off into orbit into an unreal, nebulous world. His brain slips a cog and completely derails from reality. He comes out confused and conscience-stricken, betwixt and between, his brain in limbo, to again tackle the problems of the world on Monday. He remains torn, betwixt and between two incompatible worlds, the world of reality, and an unreal world as prescribed by a bunch of Jewish scriptwriters of unknown identity. His mind is paralyzed with the fear of hell, that fiery pit, that ghastly, confined torture chamber prepared by your kind, loving, merciful, gracious, and Jewish God for 99% of his beloved victims. At this time, we might as well also raise the question, just when did God, in his wisdom, create hell and the devil? Was it on the first day when he created heaven and earth? Did Christ, one of the Holy Trinity, who always was and undoubtedly must have existed at the time hell was created, did he also participate in the designing and creation of hell? Since God knows all, sees all, both forwards and backwards, did he not therefore plan sending all these human beings that he was creating into hell sometime in the future so that he could torture them at will? Taking a closer look at the devil, we are given to understand that this also was an accident, that God really created him as an angel, but that he fell. As a result of this unexplained little accident, we have a serious antagonist on the other side from God, who is vying, it seems, in a game of cat and mouse to corral more of us poor unfortunate pawns into his side of the fence than God is able to get on his side of the fence. The way the story is told to us, it would seem that God is desperately trying to save us all for heaven, but the devil is more clever and more devious and more successful in inveigling us into hell. It would seem obvious that God is losing and his accident is winning. What a preposterous and droll situation this is. Here we are led to believe that God is infallible, all-knowing. Not a hair falls from our head, but that he is in control and in charge. Yet in all the major points he seems to have goofed, all to our, the human being's, detriment. First of all, Adam and Eve went wrong on the first day and fell into a booby trap that God had evidently set. Secondly, he had to drown all the millions of offspring that ensued, except for one family. Then they all went badly anyway. This droll story then goes on to tell us that he had to father a son from a married Jewess by the name of Mary, and had him nailed to the cross and bled dry, because that was supposed to save us miserable sinners from going to hell. But after 2,000 years, that evidently went far wrong also, since today we find fewer people than ever believing in Christianity anymore, and the Jews and communists are taking over the world. But in any case, the proposition that here is this all-knowing, infallible God, who by a quirk of an accident has created a devil instead of an angel. This devil is now a hot competitor of his, and according to the story in the Bible, is going to win the game, crowding human beings into his hell, created by God, way beyond anything that the original creator will be able to salvage for his heaven. Can you think of anything more ludicrous? As a famous general once said, anyone that will believe that kind of cock and bull story will believe anything. Nevertheless, we find that the Bible has been written, and hundreds of millions of members of the white race have succumbed to it. There certainly must be some motive behind it, other than telling silly stories. And there is. The answer becomes fairly obvious when we look at A, who wrote both the Old and the New Testaments, and B, who benefited thereby. When we consider that the Old and the New Testament were both written by a parcel of slimy Jews, then the whole nefarious conspiracy begins to make sense. We have already reviewed the treacherous and conspiratorial nature of the Jewish race over the thousands of years. We have also reviewed their history and how, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, they came back on the Romans, not by force of arms, but by treachery, trickery, conniving. By foisting upon the once proud and powerful Roman Empire the suicidal Christian religion, they destroyed Rome. We all know that 1,000 years of the Dark Ages followed the collapse of Rome, during which the white race wallowed in ignorance, poverty, and superstition. We know that when the white race did finally extricate itself partially from this perversion of the mind during the Renaissance, the Jew was there in his midst, still in control of the white man's finances, his government, and his religion. We know that the Romans, who produced the greatest civilization of ancient times, and probably of all time, 2,000 years ago were dominant without competition in the then known world. We know that this was one of the finest manifestations of the energetic and productive characteristics of the white race. We are also aware of the fact that once this great proud race succumbed to the perfidious and treacherous Christian teaching, it was never again the same, and that the white race has never been in charge of its destiny. The parasitic Jew has been in charge of the world ever since. The answer is therefore quite obvious that Christianity has been, and is today, a powerful tool used by the conniving and conspiratorial Jewish race to overcome, disintegrate, and destroy the great white race. It is being used more flagrantly than ever today to mongrelize and hasten the white man's destruction so that he can be more permanently enslaved and thereby become a meek and humble and yet productive beast of burden for the parasitic Jew. In short, the Jew invented Christianity, perpetuated it upon the white race in order that he could turn him into a perfect goyim, his term for submissive cattle. Yes, that is my conclusion, and that is my verdict. It is the only conclusion that makes sense. The time is long overripe for the white man to have a religion of his own, one that was formulated by white men, and one that was designed for the survival, expansion, and advancement of the white race. It is the overriding purpose of this book to lay the groundwork for such a religion.